Today, a market update, fact, fiction, and sentiment. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I wanted to look at the latest movements on the markets and also look at some of the issues underlying and explaining some of those movements. The Dow retreated on Friday as stimulus negotiations look set to drag on into the weekend on differences over the Federal Reserve's use of emergency lending powers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.41% and the S&P slipped 0.19%, while the Nasdaq slipped 0.07%, although all three indices closed higher for the week. In a sign that outstanding issues remain on stimulus talks, Senate Majority Mitch McConnell is reportedly seeking to propose a two-day stopgap funding fill to keep the government open and to buy more time to get a deal over the line, according to Politico. Republicans reportedly want to curb the Federal Reserve's use of emergency lending powers, while Democrats want to grant the central bank more leeway still to carry out the measures, casting doubt on hopes a deal would be sealed by the end of the week. Some believe the Fed's use of emergency lending programs have pushed the central bank to operate beyond its monetary policy purview. That said, President Donald Trump supports the Republican efforts to rein in the Fed's power. We are strongly in support of Senator Toomey's view with respect to the Treasury Emergency Funds, National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow told reporters, according to Reuters. And House Leader Nancy Pelosi reportedly twice delayed her press conference on the progress of stimulus, adding to investor jitters. The day of red on Wall Street was led by value stocks, those tied to the progress of the economy, with real estate and consumer discretionary stocks among the biggest decliners. But energy stocks were not far behind, falling more than 1%, as the threat of demand of fresh restrictions to curb rising COVID-19 cases weighed on sentiment. In fact, in the US, coronavirus cases topped 17 million, with more than 3,600 deaths recorded on Thursday. But now the US has added a second COVID-19 vaccine to its arsenal, which boosts efforts to beat back an outbreak so dire that the nation is regularly recording more than 3,000 deaths a day. And in fact, California has emerged as one of the most lethal hotspots in the US, with hospitals running out of intensive care beds and ambulances lining up outside emergency rooms in scenes reminiscent of the calamity around New York City last spring. California on Friday reported over 41,000 new cases and 300 more deaths. Much-needed doses of the Moderna vaccine are set to arrive on Monday after the Food and Drug Administration authorised an emergency rollout of the vaccine developed by Moderna and the National Institute of Health. The move marks the world's first authorization for Moderna shots. The vaccine is very similar to the one from Pfizer and German BioNTech that has already been approved in the United Kingdom and in the US. Earlier results of large unfinished studies show both vaccines appear safe and strongly protective, although Moderna's is easier to handle since it doesn't need to be stored at ultra-frozen temperatures. A second vaccine represents a ray of hope amid despair as the virus continues to spread unabated across the US and Europe, even before holiday gatherings that are certain to further fuel the outbreak. Now, of course, Australia has not yet given final approval for either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, and a University of Queensland vaccine trial was abandoned earlier. Back in the US in tech, Intel closed 6.3% lower on fears over a further dent in its chip business, as Microsoft is reportedly set to design its own chips for servers and Surface PCs, as reported by Bloomberg. And industrials, meanwhile, were held back by a 5% plunge in FedEx after the shipping giant's lack of guidance and weaker than expected margins in its ground business offset better than expected second quarter results. In other news, Tesla hit a record high of $684.74 before pairing some gains to trade about 1.5% higher as the electric car maker joined the S&P 500 index after the markets closed. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500 options, was down 1.64% to 2167, and gold futures for February delivery were down 0.24% to 1885.95, and elsewhere in commodities trading, crude oil rose 1.49% or 0.72 to hit 49.08 a barrel. The euro-US dollar was down 0.13% to 1.2250, and the US dollar future index was up 0.19% to 89.91, which is an indication of a weaker dollar. In the after-hours markets, banking stocks surged as the Federal Reserve said it would allow banks to buy back stocks and pay out dividends, as its stress tests suggest banks, quote, had strong capital levels. The Fed decided to keep restrictions on banks buying back stock and paying out dividends through to March after completing round two of the bank stress test. Still, the central bank is allowing them to buy back their stocks. JP Morgan Chase announced a new $30 billion stock repurchase authorization, and Goldman Sachs said it would restart its share repurchases next quarter. For the first quarter, both dividends and share repurchases are limited to an amount based on income over the past year. And if the bank doesn't earn income, it won't be able to pay a dividend or buy back stocks. The Fed's December 2020 stress test showed that 33 banks and financial institutions it tested would show substantial losses and lower revenue under hypothetical recessions, but would continue to lend to creditworthy businesses and households. So, well, that's okay then. Under the December test, aggregate losses for the 33 firms would be $629 billion under the severely adverse scenario, which is more than $550 billion projected under the June stress test. Despite higher loan losses compared to the June stress test, projected provisions for loan losses are smaller. The Fed said provisions are projected to be $429 billion under the severely adverse scenarios versus $499 billion in the June test. This difference reflects a significant increase in firms' loss reserves since the beginning of the year. The central bank said the minimum CET1 ratio fell to between 7.7 and 9.5% under the various scenarios considered in the sensitive analysis. And this range is lower than the December stress test projected minimum ratios of 9.6 and 9.7% under the severely adverse and alternative severe scenarios, respectively. The difference is partially attributed to the increase in loan loss reserves during the first half of 2020. The Fed conducted the December stress test with measured sensitivities to three scenarios in response to the economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the Fed stress test estimated that banks had enough capital to cover $600 billion of losses in a sudden economic downturn. JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America and Citigroup jumped all more than 5% higher in after-hours trade. And of course, earlier this week, the Federal Reserve had kept rates unchanged on Wednesday and signalled that near zero rates would continue through to 2023 to support the next phase of the economic recovery as the vaccine rollout gets underway. The Federal Open Market Committee left its benchmark rate unchanged in the range of 0% to 0.25%. The low rate environment will continue for some time, with policymakers backing rates to remain unchanged right the way through to 2023. The Fed's interest rate outlook for 2020 through 2023 was 0.1%, unchanged from previous projections in September. The central bank pledged to maintain its near zero interest rate range for some time, and it comes as the recovery has slowed recently amid rising infections that have triggered restrictions and exacerbated concerns over the uncertain economic outlook. Despite the recent slowdown, the Fed has upped its outlook on growth, though it reiterated the ongoing pandemic poses, quote, considerable risks to the economic outlook over the medium term. The economy is expected to contract by 2.4% in 2020, up from an estimated 3.7% contraction previously. For 2021, the Fed expects the economy to grow 4.2% and 3.2% in 2022. That's up from previous estimates of 4% and 3% respectively. And the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, said the first quarter data will show a significant impact from a surge in the virus, but that the economy should perform strongly in the second half of next year, underpinned by a boost from the vaccine rollout. The unemployment rate for the year is expected to come down at 6.7%, which is down from 7.6% previously cited, and will fall further to 5% next year, down from a previous estimate of 5.5%. The unemployment rate was estimated to improve further and eventually drop to 3.7% in 2023, down from a prior estimate of 4%, and the pace of inflation, which the Fed has earmarked as a key driver of future monetary policy decisions, is forecast to cool to a rate of 1.4% this year, but then improve to 1.8% next year, compared with the prior estimates of 1.5% and 1.7% respectively. And looking ahead, inflation is projected to reach 2%, although the Fed has reiterated that it would let inflation run above that target for some long time. The committee, it said, will aim to achieve inflation moderately above 2% for some time, so that inflation averages 2% over time, and longer-term inflation expectations remain well anchored at 2%, the Fed said. With rates near the zero-bound level, the central bank has relied on its bond-buying purchases to steady the economic fallout, buying $120 billion of bonds on a monthly basis. The bond-buying program has seen the Fed's balance sheet rise above $7 trillion from $4 trillion just before the pandemic struck in early March. But the Fed appears to be in no hurry to curb the pace of purchases. The current pace of bond buying will continue, quote, until substantial further progress has been made towards the committee's maximum employment and price stability goals, the Fed said. These asset purchases help foster smooth market functioning and accommodative financial conditions, thereby supporting the flow of credit to households and businesses. Ahead of the FOMC meeting, someone floated the idea of the Fed adopting a Bank of Canada approach by trimming bond purchases to target longer duration bonds. But Powell said the view among Fed members on the BOC approach was mixed and wasn't high on the list of possibilities. Now, turning to Bitcoin, it had a good week, up to 23,100 US, even as analysts debate whether the US Treasury Secretary's new rule about self-custodied wallets could place the current bull run in peril. There were various media reports that US Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was considering whether or not legislation governing self-custodized wallets should be implemented. This led some analysts and crypto pundits to speculate whether or not this would impact Bitcoin and the current bullish momentum that has been driving crypto prices higher recently. The threat of new crypto sector focused regulation is a credible event, which has negatively impacted crypto prices in the past, but some are saying this time there might be a few reasons why the proposed rule probably wouldn't lead to a Bitcoin price crash. Initially, some industry watchers were worried that prices could fall. Certainly, there was the view that the regulation could be detrimental to the entire cryptocurrency sector. And comments from various industry heavyweights led the entire industry to become cautious about the planned rule proposal. But other reports suggest that the rule might require multiple transactions that are equivalent to $10,000 a day to be reported by financial institutions. Compared with the initial rumours about the rule, it is arguably less rigorous than it appears. In fact, some experts say the proposed rule is similar to those that already exist. Considering the rule would be less restrictive than the initial planned regulation, and the fact that the market has had significant time to act on it, it's possible the market has already priced in this potential regulation. There are two main paths Mnuchin could take to introduce the self-custody wallet regulation. First, he could take the conventional route of rulemaking, which requires a hearing and a 30-day period. And if you took the conventional approach, the proposals would have to be released this week before the current presidential term comes to an end. Although, alternatively, Minchin could aim for a, quote, good cause way of passing the regulation. This would allow Minchin to speed up the process. I think at this point it's more likely that Minchin will take the conventional approach. To take the good cause method, he would need to find sufficient evidence to prove that crypto sees significant criminal activity. Hence, the probability that the proposed rule would be introduced in the upcoming days remains the highest, which would be optimistic for Bitcoin. Now a quick look at the Australian markets. On Friday, Australian stocks were lower after the close on Friday as losses in the IT, real estate trusts and financial sectors led shares lower. At the close in Sydney, the ASX 200 lost 1.2%. The best performers of the session were Whitehaven Coal, which rose 5.98%, and Megaport Limited added 5.12%. New Farm was up 4.83%. The worst performers of the session were Mio Blast, which fell 36.07% to trade at 241, and A2 Milk declined 23.64% to end at 1014, and QBE Insurance was down 12.46% to 871. And falling stocks outnumbered advancing ones on the Sydney Stock Exchange by 715 to 564, while 351 ended unchanged. Now, the markets were partly reacting to the new COVID infections around Sydney's northern beaches, which will be locked down until Wednesday after a 23 count of new COVID cases were reported today, 21 of which directly linked to the Avalon outbreak in Sydney's northern beaches. Two other cases are still under investigation. The Avalon cluster is now at 38 cases, with 15 cases linked to the Avalon RSL, 23 cases linked to the Avalon Bowling Club, and several cases attended both venues. The northern beaches area will now be in lockdown from 5 p.m. on Saturday to midnight on Wednesday, with people being asked to stay at home unless, quote, for essential reasons. The reasons permitted for leaving home are work, for compassionate grounds, exercise, and for shopping. And people will also not be permitted to enter the Northern Beaches LGA unless any of those reasons apply. Hospitality venues, function centres, gyms, and places of worship will close. And Premier Berejiklian also flagged that restrictions could be extended across Greater Sydney if it was warranted. I should say, to put everybody on notice, we'll be considering today, after consulting obviously the relevant people, whether this time tomorrow we do revert back to some restrictions in Greater Sydney. But we're still considering that, she said. I just want to put everyone notice that there is a possibility and it will depend on the health advice sent to us during the course of the day. She said that the Northern Beaches lockdown had been introduced because of the likelihood there will be a repeat of a similar rise in case numbers over the next 24 hours. And she urged people not to panic given the temporary restrictions. We are hoping that this will give us sufficient time to get on top of the virus so we can then ease up for Christmas and the new year moving forward, she says. And she said that people in Sydney outside of the Northern Beaches should avoid all unnecessary travel. Can I say to everyone in other parts of Sydney, outside the northern beaches, please limit your activity, she said. We're asking you to do this in good faith. We're asking you not to undertake non-essential travel or non-essential activity. If you're planning a night out tonight, we ask you to consider changing those plans and staying at home. And I just want to make the point there. Of course, I've been arguing in my scenarios that the central case is going to include various waves of virus activity. And I'm afraid that this is one more reason why I think many of the scenarios that other people have been propagating recently are overblown. And finally, the narrative suggesting that quantitative easing and money printing will lead to massive inflation is, to quote, a fairy tale, according to investing.com. The same story was told nearly a decade ago and it simply never developed, leaving many investors very disappointed. The Fed has gone out of its way to tell investors that the lack of inflation is the biggest threat it faces. What seems hard to understand then is why inflation-linked assets like gold and Bitcoin are surging. The fairy tale started a decade ago when the Fed launched QE for the first time. The narrative that quickly began was that inflation would soon follow, and while some asset prices rose for a little bit, it did not last long. Nearly a decade later, even before the pandemic, the Fed was still searching for higher prices. It means that today's investors are likely facing the same disappointment that it did over a decade ago. Gold prices began rising sharply in late 2008 from around $750, peaking in August 2011 at $1,900, and the metal proceeded to decline in value for the next 7 years, falling as low as $1,000. It wasn't much different for copper, which surged from around $130 to almost $470. That metal also lost value over the same period. Now, amazingly, we're seeing prices of gold and copper soar along with other commodities. And of course, we have Bitcoin, which has joined the fairy tale as money printing from the Fed is sure to leave to the dollar's debasement and stoke inflation rates, some say. But one can easily see in the following charts that it's simply not true. QE itself never promoted inflation following the great financial crisis. The trimmed mean PCE reading of inflation only passed 2% on a handful of occasions since 2009. And we also know, based on M2 and MZM velocity, too much money printing pushes inflation rates lower. A simple chart of M2 and MZM velocity compared to 10-year rates quickly demonstrates that. The velocity of the money stock is a simple ratio of GDP divided by M2 or MZM. The faster those money quantities rise versus GDP, the slower the money spreads around, because there isn't enough stuff being created to increase the demand, pushing prices higher. For example, in the early 1980s, $1 created in MZM created nearly $3.80 in GDP. Today, $1 created in MZM makes just $1 in GDP. Disinflation is at work. And the biggest problem with the economy may face in the future is that GDP is simply too slow for the money being printed. All of the money being created by the Fed today sits in three places: the balance sheet of the banks, the US Treasury, and currency in circulation. Those three accounts hold $6.7 trillion of the Fed's $7.2 trillion balance sheet. Therefore, it is impossible to create the inflation that so many are betting will happen so long as the money remains in those accounts of the Fed. The concept that all of the money printing today will result in a run-up in prices and produce massive inflation is nearly precisely identical to what happened in 2009 and 2010. The dynamics are likely to end the same way today as it did back then, with disappointed investors that latched on to the same fairy tale. And if you want more on inflation and deflation, look at my recent post with Steve Van Meter, where he and I took that argument even further. So we are at quite a precipitous point in the cycle at the moment. And of course, the virus is still there and is going to have continued health and economic impacts. But beyond that, all of the quantitative easing and money printing and low interest rates are likely to have a deflationary, not inflationary effect. And that means that, as well as gold and Bitcoin being overpriced, stock markets are also overpriced. And it becomes a question as not if, but when markets wake up and realize that and start correcting down. But that may take some little time. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.